Coming up on this week's show, a gaming legend's lost work has been preserved.
Atari returns to the arcade.
And we chat Origin Systems, Star Wars, and Her Interactive with Sherry Grainer Ray.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. Now, you've got to check out their current volume, N64, a visual compendium, celebrating the best screenshots and games art of over 150 titles that defined the Nintendo 64. So I'll tell you more about that in just a bit, and you can check it out in the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 421, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show. Of course, a podcast that every single week brings you up to speed on what's been happening in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology. And of course, bringing you a very special guest in the second half of the podcast to tell us their story from working in the video games industry. Now, I've got to say, now, having done this podcast now for over 8 years, if you look back on our list of guests that we've had, I'd like to say, you know, we do try and keep it quite diverse and get different people on from different parts of the world that have done different things in the industry. One problem we've probably always had, though, is trying to get more women on the show, because you look back, particularly the eras that we cover on the podcast, like, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, it wasn't that much of a diverse industry back then, was it? It was very male-orientated.
Yeah, and there's some absolutely amazing female developers out there. And, you know, we really think gaming's for everyone, and inclusiveness is a great part of video games.
Yeah, so today we're going to be joined by probably one of the most famous women who's worked in the video games industry for many decades now, and worked for some huge companies as well. I mean, just listing off a few of the companies she's worked for: Origin Systems, LucasArts, the Cartoon Network, American Laser Games, who you might remember American Laser Games for those games that were everywhere in the arcades back in the early 90s, like Mad Dog McCree.
Oh, those FMV games. Yeah, I absolutely love them.
And then Sherry went on to work for Her Interactive. Now, they're quite a unique company, because really the mission of Her Interactive, they were a spin-off of American Laser Games, specifically devoted to making games that were targeted towards females.
Yeah, and they did some great games, like Mackenzie and Co. was a dating game as well, which started out. But then later on, they got the Nancy Drew series, which was incredibly popular. And, you know, we cover a lot of the history of Sherry's career, but also we talk about, you know, some of the books that she's wrote about gender inclusiveness and about MMOs as well, and how that world's kind of opened up gaming to a lot of people.
Yeah, and she's worked with, you know, some legends of the industry as well, and some huge franchises. Star Wars she worked on as well, Star Wars Galaxies.
Ultima.
Yeah, well, the Ultima games back when she was at Origin Systems. And like you said, she's a really big advocate for, you know, women in gaming, both as industry professionals and players as well. And, you know, it's something like that she still campaigns for to this day. So a really interesting chat with our very special guest, Sherry Grainer Ray. She's coming up on the podcast in around half an hour from now. But of course, you know the way the podcast works. First half of it, that's when we have a little natter about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming from over the last week. And this was very nice to see. Now, I did mention, you know, talking about our guest list that we've had on the podcast over the years. One of my favorite interviews that we ever did, and someone who's just an absolute legend, who very sadly passed away a couple of years ago, was Archie MacLean. Now, I remember playing his games like, you know, Jimmy White's Worldwind Snooker. And to this day, you know, Archie MacLean's pool on the Amiga, still one of my favorite pool simulators. And that was kind of jaw-dropping when I first saw that game as a kid, you know, those kind of 3D graphics, just incredible games. And we met Archer, I think it was Play Expo in London when we interviewed him live, wasn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, he worked on these games, but he also had some absolutely fantastic stories about the kind of background of these games, and, you know, especially Jimmy White's as well, and just kind of some great tales about what was going on. And, you know, he was an avid collector as well. I think he had an absolutely huge watch collection.
Yeah, I remember that, because we did a panel with him, and he was kind of showing us loads of pictures of his watch collection, wasn't he? For about 15 minutes before we started the panel, we're like, we'll probably need to crack on now. But he's that passionate about watches.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. And of course, you know, international karate, legendary game back in the day.
Oh, gosh,
but this is quite nice to see that, obviously, Archer passed away a couple of years ago. But it turns out some of his arcade experiments have been preserved by the website Games That Weren't.
Yeah, so he was he actually had quite a few ports in the works. Well, I say in the works from the 80s.
Yeah.
That never came to be for the Atari 400 and the Atari 800. So there were some graphical tests for Donkey Kong and Tempest, as well as a Pole Position clone.
Nice.
Which he'd made as well, called Road Roller, which have been preserved. But the main one that people are talking about is actually a game that was actually covered in Zap 64 magazine back in the day, that never actually came out, which is a port of Robotron. And there's a whole video, you know, kind of like with a deep dive into all the assets of the games and stuff like that. And I was watching the Robotron version of it earlier on. And yeah, it looks nice and colourful.
He's got all the sprites, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's got all the sprites. Yeah, it's got all the sprites and everything. And it's a pretty far on version of it, if right. you will. But yeah, it's funny because obviously I've never really been interested in the Atari 400 and 800, but I just keep seeing it everywhere. And I know this is obviously from 40 years ago and, you know, obviously he's passed away now and everything, but it's nice to see, you know, people are still kind of going through it and, you know, preserving these old games that could have been.
I guess this is what, you know, developers do, and they want to explore a new system. They might just port something that they already know or you know, one of their own titles, or change something to kind of learn how it works and, you know, learn that environment, basically.
Mm. It's great to see as well, because I mean, these are 5 1/4 inch floppies, and I love actually, you know, there's some images of them, his handwritten labels, you know, dating from 1983 on there too. And it's great that, you know, number one, these discs still work after all these years, but also that he kept them for that long as well, because there's got to be so many of these kind of stories. And you always hear about, you know, like legendary developers like Archer who might pass away, and you always kind of wonder, you know, is there anything kind of left like in their attic, you know, stuff they were working on? So I think it is nice to see that his efforts have been preserved.
I think that's a great point, that, you know, that they're still working, and it's kind of like, get them, you know, get them preserved now before they go, you know?
Yeah, obviously, you know, someone as famous and well-regarded as Archer, it is very nice to see that his works have been preserved now. And actually, you can download them. So if you fancy poking around and, you know, looking at the abandoned workings of a coding genius, as Tam Extension nicely word it, I'll link that up in this week's show notes as well. Now, this is very cool. We're seeing a lot of these retro-style 3D games coming out recently. We mentioned that one that was inspired by Desert Strike the other week on the podcast, which was nice to see, getting some love on our Twitter actually the other day as well. A few people had discovered it through the podcast. And this one looks incredible. This is a new Sega Saturn style parking garage racer game. Now, how much fun does this look?
This looks like absolute hell to me. I hate parking multi-story car parks and tight spaces, but I'm well impressed with the graphics and stuff. And yeah, and to be honest, these ones look a lot more fun than the council ones that I have to go around to drive in.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Ravi, because I just think the premise of this game is like so typically British. But yeah, Parking Garage Rally Circuit, it's called.
Or actually, the guys behind it are actually from LA.
And maybe maybe the parking garages are much cooler in America. Like, ours are really not cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, well, funny you should say that. So the premise of the game is described, it is meant to feel like an unreleased Sega Saturn game from 1998. That's how it's meant to feel. That's how it's meant to look.
And it does look like that. Yeah, they've got it down to a T. Yeah.
Certainly got the look down. And then the premise of the game is you can travel across the US and also the UK, picking which parking garages you want to race around. So you can go to UK ones, apparently.
Free with pee smell in the stairwell.
But I totally agree with you, Ravi. I can't stand parking in the big concrete multi-stories either. But yeah, it's just funny because it's very in the vein of like Colin McRae Rally.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like it's, you know, tell you like sharp left here kind of thing. And, you know, you've got your checkpoints and everything, but it's all set around one of these big concrete circular parking multi-stories, which is just such a bizarre premise.
It feels really tight. Like, so, you know, the camera is really close up to the car.
Yeah.
It's very much zoomed in further than other racing games where you're quite zoomed out. And I guess that's because you're in the limited, narrow space.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it does work well because that's like a nostalgic kind of camera angle as well.
Reminds me of Sega Rally on the Saturn, probably.
Yeah, Sega Rally.
Took the words right out of my mouth. I was literally about to say Sega Rally. And that is the whole point of it. It's meant to be, you know, one of these rally driving simulators, but rather than going around kind of like, you know, farmlands, tight dirt tracks, the idea is it's meant to be these really, really tight, horrible corners that you get in parking garages. And then the idea is you're meant to drift around them and get your boosts and obviously beat the high score, beat the times on them and stuff, and kind of make your way either down or up the multi-story, which just seems like... It seems like such a stupid, boring premise, but they've made the game. It does look really fast and exciting. And I'm not a big fan of racing games, but I'm like, yeah, I'd quite like to play this.
But also, this could be a game made back then because of the limitations of the graphics. Like, you're not really doing much graphically there. You haven't got these huge mountains in the background. You haven't got all of this. You've got, you know, a scene and you've got walls and then... kind of so
100%
that like limited graphic style is something they've recreated, and being on modern systems they could probably have just gone all out, but that's nostalgic in its own way.
You've captured it straight away there. You know, the backgrounds of the games as you're coming down the multi-story, you know, it's the kind of like the old pixelated photos that you'd see in the back of like Tekken 1. I know that was a PlayStation game, but you know, they really have captured that static image just like across the horizon.
I'd love it. So if you drive, it's like, you drive to the end, you get to the barrier and it's like, you forgot your ticket and then you have to run out and buzz to someone and go, can I get a new ticket printed, please?
Yeah, while there's a queue of cars behind you beeping the horn angrily.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Well, unfortunately, no signs of it coming out on console or Sega Saturn at the moment. It is going to be on Steam.
Yeah.
But you never know with these things. If they're popular enough, they do get ported to, you know, Switch and PlayStation and stuff. But seeing this on the Saturn would be fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. And it's got no release date or pricing as yet. I mean, these games, you know, generally not all that expensive, are they? Normally around the £10 kind of mark, so hopefully it will be that. But you can wishlist that on Steam now. Looks loads of fun. Now, this is quite an interesting story for those of us who like to play our retro games on a proper cathode ray tube television, which I think is, it's all of us guys now, isn't it? I know Joe got into the CRT craze again a couple of years ago.
Yeah. I've actually got two CRTs in my game.
Fancy
pens.
Someone's doing well.
Yeah, I know. Fancy. I mean, they were given to me. But yeah.
There is something about playing games on the original screens that they were designed for, which, you know, when you've got the original consoles hooking them up, that's an easy job. But when you get into the realms of devices like the Mister, it can be a little bit trickier to get them working on retro machines. But this is quite interesting. This is a new project called MisterCast that lets you mirror your PC screen to a classic CRT TV.
Yeah, so this is interesting because it's basically enabling the Mister to do that. So you could do this if you had like a HDMI to AV converter and a Chromecast.
With loads of latency.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Yeah, you could do that and it would be laggy. You could play videos on their classic stuff and, you know, they showed the demo of this and they had sliders on it straight away, which I was like, yes, that's a classic 90s sci-fi show. But what this does is this enables the Mister itself to receive the PC screen and then have that connected to your CRT. Now, it works by a special core that runs on there, which is like an analog GPU core. You were asking me about this earlier, weren't you?
Yeah, the Groovy Mister.
Yes, so Groovy MAME is basically a fork of MAME that focuses on CRT monitor support, and that would run like on your PC, transfer the data to your Mister, and then that core runs on your Mister connected to the CRT TV. So it's basically like your Mister's acting as a mega fast Chromecast without the lag. But now you can send your whole PC screen. So you can have titles that aren't available natively on the Mr. Core, you know, latest PC games.
And you can play stuff off your Steam library then, essentially.
Steam library, yeah. Any other emulators or platforms that you've got running on your PC, send that straight to the Mr. Mr. has the, you know, input, so there's hardly any latency, and then have that bam straight onto your CRT TV. So it's essentially like a good thing for people who have misters in a way to upgrade it and, you know, add more functionality to it.
I like the fact as well that you can basically send, so pretty much anything you're looking at on your PC desktop, you just mirrors that.
Yeah,
to the CRT.
That's what
so,
I think. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if you know, I've actually set up a Chromecast on a CRT before using an HDMI to analog converter. And I was streaming like old episodes of Games Master from my phone to the Chromecast, watching it on a CRT, which to me, you know, it was like, it was quite a nostalgic experience kind of watching a TV show that I used to watch on a CRT back in the day, actually on one again. So that was quite nice to see.
Well, something like Sonic Mania.
Yeah.
You know, blasting that, that would be absolutely perfect. And, you know, I guess there's going to, it's an early version. There's a few bugs and stuff, and it's going to be relying on your internet connection and how your wireless is. And, you know, if you actually have all the correct stuff in there, but it's a really cool little concept.
Yeah. And the only thing I'm thinking is that obviously a lot of games today are made for widescreens. I guess probably they'd be letterboxed on a 4x3
yeah,
CRT.
Yeah, you'd have to play around with the settings, wouldn't you, and get the right native resolution.
Yeah, but very cool to see. I mean, you know, how many games do we see these days that have got, you know, inbuilt like CRT filters and all that in there in the settings, actually having it on a proper old-school display, I think is very cool. You mentioned Sonic Mania, though, because that is a game that does require really fast reflexes. So it would be interesting to see. That would be a good example of something
or
going
even
on this.
Cuphead or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So to see if I'm even worse than I normally am on Cuphead playing at the CRT. So, yeah, very cool. If you have got a Mister, that is available now on GitHub. So I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Now, speaking of games that needed a CRT back in the day, probably the most famous light gun game of all time. You guys fans of Duck Hunt? Did you play that much back in the day?
Absolutely loved it. Yeah. You go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I played it.
Thanks for your input. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, obviously, very famous game that required a light gun on the NES.
Yeah, my friend had one. We'd just absolutely batter it. Like, Duck Hunt was one of the things that we play as little kids, just constantly. Absolutely loved it. And of course, you could cheat by running straight up to the screen.
But, I was about to say
never,
that's what.
Yeah, we never allowed
that. That's what we did. Yeah, yeah.
I never knew this. What could you do?
You could just hold the gun up really close to the TV.
That's it.
You tell me.
Press it.
Yeah. And just press it and you'd pretty much never miss. My wife caught me doing it a few years ago at the Nottingham Video Game Museum, you know, the one that moved to Sheffield.
Yeah.
They had Duck Hunt set up on the top floor and I was playing it for ages and, you know, got right up to like the last levels and I was struggling with it. So she caught me just like stood right up to the TV and she was like, what are you doing? I was like, nothing.
And you need one of those fairly big CRTs to play
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Obviously incredible game if you're into those light gun zapper games of the 80s. But actually there is a very respectable port of this, obviously unofficial. We don't draw attention to this from anyone at Nintendo. But now this has been ported. An enhanced remake of Duck Hunt has come to the Amiga.
Have you ever used a light gun on the Amiga, Dan?
No. I think I've told the story before on the podcast of when I first got my Amiga 500 because I had a problem with my A500. The screen used to like scramble. I think there's a problem with the chip RAM or something in it. So we returned it to Dixon's and got like a new machine, like basically they swapped it over. But when I was in there and my mum was filling in the paperwork and everything, the guy that worked at Dixon's, he came over to me and goes, oh, do you want a light gun for your Amiga? And I remember thinking at the time he was going to give me one for free.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, being 11 years old and be like, wow, like that. And he goes, yeah, tell your mum they're only like £49. I was like, it's never going to happen then. But yeah, that was the closest I ever came
to
actually
seeing. I think there was one called the Trojan Phaser.
Right.
Trojan did this like light pen as well, which was one kind of thing as well.
And I love light pens. I've never owned one, but
it was the same people that made that. And it worked for the ST as well. Yeah. And I remember there was quite a few light gun games for the Amiga, actually, but I never had one. So I was always, you know, playing it with the mouse. But this does look like a very, very accurate port.
Yeah, well, this is, you mentioned about playing it with the mouse. That is how this version of the game is controlled. So it's not actually a light gun game. It's basically, yeah, you use a mouse to aim the sight on the screen. But it looks very good, doesn't it? I think graphically, they've done some nice enhancements there. You know, the shading on it is very nice. The sound effects are great as well. There's actually, I think it is the shotgun sound from Doom.
Yeah, I think they've done the kind of Redux really well. You know, obviously it's not the original NES version. It's like enhanced, but it does look really good.
I think it does look really nice. Obviously, it's not just running on an A500. Mm. There's quite a few things going on in there, which obviously are beyond me because I'm not an Amiga guy. But I think the look of it, you know, if you were to just show me this, I'd say it was like a HD version for the Switch, like straight away.
Really?
Yeah. No, I think it looks really smooth and really nice. It's just the only thing that gives it away is obviously is the fact that it's not a light gun. It is just a mouse, you know, with a crosshair kind of going around on the screen. But yeah, you're definitely right about the Doom sound effect there, Dan. I think it's wicked.
I think if you're playing it with a light gun or something, it's going to be the accuracy of how you're actually playing it that's going to give you the real feel of Duck Hunt, you know.
Which apparently, yeah, this doesn't support light guns from what I can see natively, but I've never used a light gun on the Amiga. How did they kind of work then? Was it you had to have games that were specifically made for it, or could the light gun basically emulate the mouse?
I think so. I just remember quite a few games having that option in there, but maybe they never had support for it. They might have just kind of been, you know, mouse shooting ones. There was a lot of that back in the days.
Yeah, because I mean, if it could emulate a mouse, then yeah, it would be possible to play this with a light gun, I imagine, which would be the most authentic way of playing it. But yeah, it looks really good, actually. And I think you need about 2 megabytes of RAM to run this. Obviously, you need a slightly expanded Amiga 500 if you want to run this game. But it's not really a problem for most people these days. Obviously, you can play it on the A500 Mini or emulation. So it looks very good. And like all things that are Nintendo's IP, I would grab that while you can. Now, just one more story to talk about before we hop into our special guest this week, Sherry Grainerae, talking about Origin Systems, Star Wars, lots more as well. Now, Atari obviously have been doing some really incredible things recently. But if you think of Atari's legacy, it is really in the arcade, isn't it? And it turns out that Atari have actually been away from the arcade for 25 years. But that is going to change soon.
Yeah, 25 years. It sounds like so long, but also, like, yes, that would make sense because obviously arcades kind of died in the late 90s, early 2000s with the advancements of home consoles, etc. And it does feel like every week we're talking about Atari and how they're kind of like knocking it out of the park at the moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're partnering up with a company called Alan One Inc., which Ravi thought was just a person called Alan One, but they are a company and they're named after Tron.
Tron, of course, yeah.
But they're going to be bringing its Atari's Recharge series to arcades. So the Recharge series was about 3 or 4 years ago where they did some kind of like HD remasters of some classic Atari games, like Missile Command, Yar's Revenge, Centipede, kind of really nice, glowy, neon kind of versions of those games.
Yeah, the beautiful look. I've got the Asteroids one on the Switch. It plays
Yeah, well. Yeah, they're on Switch and Steam and PlayStation and Xbox, etc. And they've been out a few years, but they're going to be bringing them to arcades. In full-size arcade cabinets, apparently. And Atari are saying that, you know, they're going to try and put them in, like, you know, really kind of enriching, they've described it as enriching location-based arcade experience. So I'm guessing they're going to kind of, I don't really know what that means, but I'm guessing they're going to try and put it in some of these, like, arcades that have popped up around the world, you know, where you kind of pay 20 quid and you get to go in all day.
Yeah. Arcade club, that kind of thing.
Yeah, like arcade club and stuff like that. Because I noticed, you know, in Japan, there's quite a lot of them still.
Or in pubs, it could be. You know, I think that's a fancy word. Enriching the location-based experience. Yeah.
Not the kind of pubs I go in. This wouldn't last long in there.
Yeah. Get smashed up. Now, I'd be interested to see if they're going to make like 10 separate machines or if they're just going to make one machine and you can pick what you want to play on it. And I'll also be interested to see if this is going to be like a really fancy, you know, arcade cabinet that isn't going to be on sale for like the general public. It is literally going to be aimed for like premises, or if it's going to be something that you could buy for like 300-400 quid.
They've done 1UP arcades previously, Atari, you know, the legacy ones and stuff. Maybe they'll do a Recharge series on that as well. So, you know, play it outdoors and play it at home. But maybe they're just trying to focus in on that one market as well, doing it, you know, in enriched location-based facilities.
Enriched location-based facilities. It's in McDonald's.
Well, they did this company, Alan One, they did a game called Avian Knights a couple of years ago. And they did actually release an arcade cabinet for that game, which if you go to their website, which is alan-one.com, you can actually buy, it says you can pre-order an arcade cabinet for it on there. I'm just kind of looking through and trying to find pricing, but I can't see it on the website at the moment. That's the thing. So
maybe
I'm looking
you're not
at
enriched
it.
Enough.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. Check your history and be like, yeah, he's not going to.
Well, they did the Star Wars one, didn't they? And the Pac-Man one for 1UP.
Yeah. But the arcade 1UP ones, they're like flat pack kind of like furniture.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see where, like, kind of, if these are going to be aimed at, that's what I'm kind of trying to figure out here, whether this is going to be aimed at, like, the collector's home market or whether it's going to be, you know, priced so it's only affordable to arcades and places that you might play it in public.
Yeah, looking at this Avian Knights one, I've just looked it up after you've mentioned it, and I think, it's probably not going to be for the home market. It's going to be, you know, these are going to be like £2,000-£3,000, and they're going to be aimed for these arcade experience places, or, you know, in the back of like a, I'm trying to think of somewhere like a Laser Quest or a bowling alley, because they tend to still have, you know, a couple of arcade
cinemas and stuff.
Cinemas, yeah. Theatres and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, the Avian Knights one does look really nice, really expensive. So it'll be pretty cool to see, like you say, down with the trackballs and everything.
And that's the thing. I mean, I'm looking through the Alan One website to try and get a.
It'll probably be like get a quote as a wholesaler or something like that.
There is literally, Avian Knights co-op arcade two-player cabinet. It's got a dollar sign, then nothing after it. So either it's free or it's way out of my price range. I'm guessing probably the latter. But very cool to see these, though. I think, you know, because the Recharged games are really well done. You know, I played a couple on the Asteroids one, like I said, on the Switch. Is like, I've never been a great Asteroids player, but graphically, you know, it looks gorgeous. Like you said, there's kind of neon visuals, and it's interesting that, you know, the Alan One brand is named after Tron, because a lot of these games look like they could literally be straight out of a Tron movie.
Yeah,
graphically, that's
absolutely
what they look like. So, yeah, they're very well done. So nice to see Atari returning to the arcade, as, you know, basically the company that founded the arcade back in the day. So a welcome return. So if you want to read more about that, I'll link that up. And, of course, everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around. You find them all in our show notes on your podcast app, or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Right, patrons, stay tuned. We have got a couple of extra stories coming up because, you know, we do that every week for our patrons. Couple of extra news stories because we chopped the adverts out of the show, so we don't want to give them a shorter podcast. So hang about, we've got some really cool ones to talk about. For everybody else, the interview with our special guest this week, Sherry Grainer Ray, is coming up in just a second. But if you'd like to join us on Patreon, now would be a very good time to do it, because we've just dropped the latest episode of our bonus podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours.
Oh, this and was a fun one to do. I really enjoyed that. And also, if you can't, you know, join us on Patreon, drop us an iTunes review as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, that really helps out.
It really does. Any way that you can support the podcast, you know, retweeting us on social media or sharing it with your friends, that's always appreciated. Gets us in front of new people and up those all-important podcast charts. So if you want to join us on Patreon, and all the details for that are on the website at theretrohour.com. Now, of course, this podcast is brought to you every week with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books, who are our longest running sponsor on the Retro Hour. I think it's about 6 years we've worked with Sam and the team at Bitmap Books. You know, and that's the thing, having a sponsor for that long, it had to be a company whose products we really believe in and we love. And also, you know, a group of guys who we get on really well with as well, because they're just lovely people, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't be prouder to have Bitmap Books supporting us, especially for so long as well, because of the quality of their books, you know, and the books that they keep putting out are just absolutely amazing. And they're so appealing to me, you know, and if you're any sort of fan of any sort of kind of like retro video games or the history of it, you jump on their website, you will find anything that will appeal to you.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, they are really accessible as well. I mean, I've got loads of Bitmap Books books, and they're the kind of thing that, you know, like my missus will sometimes just flick through one if it's on the coffee table at home, or, you know, if my mum comes to visit, she'll be like, oh, what's that? You know, it catches people's eyes when you've got it on the shelves, I think, the design of them.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I love the front covers that they always do, you know, with all the different, like with the different sprites on there. I love those ones in particular, the Master System one, the N64 one that they've just put out, and they're just so eye-catching.
And it is awesome to see that now they are covering and celebrating one of our favorite systems. The N64 has got its own visual compendium.
Yeah, man, this looks absolutely amazing. Obviously, you know, hundreds of different games in there, you know, little nice descriptions about each one of those games, but also it unearths a lot of stories and parts of the N64 that you might not know about. There's a lot of stuff in there about the controller and also the sought-after 64DD disk drive peripheral. There's a whole section in there about that, which looks really interesting because obviously we don't really hear too much of that outside of Japan.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, like all of Bitmap Books books, you know, it's presented beautifully. You've got all the big games in there. Obviously, Mario 64, GoldenEye, Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time. It's all covered in there as well. But also stuff that you might not be all that familiar with, you know, Beetle Adventure Racing.
Oh, yeah.
World Driver Championship.
Joe knows it because he's a big fan.
Mischief Makers, Body Harvest as well. And like you said, every one of the games has got profiles written by a developer involved in the game or a journalist who's got a really deep connection with the N64 as well. And there's also a foreword in the book by David Doak, who obviously worked at Rare back in the day. So, yeah, loads of interviews by people that you'll be very familiar with if you are an N64 fan, coming in at 436 pages. Beautifully designed. The graphics on here just jump off the page. So if you want to check that out.
It's like there's a few things where you kind of have fandom and, you know, it's turned into physicality in it and it actually becomes something. And I think Bitmap Books is that kind of physical version of fandom for each little system. When you just look at it, you can tell the love that's in there, but also just reading it, it just feels so amazing with like the quality of stuff they have in there, but also, you know, like you want to preserve these books and keep them in great condition.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the works of art in themselves. So if you want to get hold of that, if you're a fan of Nintendo 64-bit wonder, N64, a visual compendium, is on sale right now. Check that out. Obviously, it helps out the podcast by supporting our sponsors. So if you want to order that and check out the rest of their catalogue as well, their website is bitmapbooks.com. Okay, our special guest on the way next, we're going to be joined by the fantastic Sherry Grainer-Ray, who worked for some incredible companies, Origin Systems, American Laser Games, Her Interactive, LucasArts as well, working on legendary titles like the Star Wars series as well. So she's coming up on the podcast next.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Sherry Grainer-Ray, video games developer and designer for some absolutely awesome companies that we love. You know, Origin Systems, American Laser Games, Her Interactive, also LucasArts Games and Cartoon Network. She's also a pioneer of inclusiveness in games. How are you doing, Sherry?
I'm doing well.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And we always ask our guests a question when we start the podcast, and that's, what was your kind of first computer experience that really stood out to you?
I had a VIC-20.
Nice.
I had a VIC-20, and we played text adventures. My brother figured out how to hook the VIC-20 up to the television, and so our whole family would sit, and we'd all together as a family play the text adventure games.
Were they the Scott Adams games?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. So why did you get a VIC-20 then? And, I mean, who in the family decided that we needed a home computer?
My brother started with them, and about that time he was moving on to the Commodore 64, and so I got his VIC-20. Even though he's my younger brother, in typical fashion, the boys got the computers, and then their sisters got the hand-me-downs, and so I got the hand-me-down VIC-20.
And what kind of things were you doing on that machine then? Was it mainly gaming, or were you like dabbling in programming or anything like that?
It was gaming, mostly the text adventure games. My brother was very active in the Commodore community, still is actually, and so he was the one that was reading all the magazines and actually doing the programming. I was more interested in the game side of it.
So tell us how you got started in the industry then. What made you want to get into the world of video games as a profession then? Kind of explain that kind of jump from, you know, playing games on the VIC-20 to working in the industry. What was that kind of path?
Well, you have to remember, when I started, there really wasn't an industry. Yeah. I started in working, my first game was at, or first job was at Origin Systems, and I started in 1989. So there really wasn't an industry back then. There was the one company here, there was Origin, and then there were a couple of companies scattered around the country, but there wasn't an industry per se. But the way I got started was by Dungeons and Dragons. I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, and usually as the DM, usually running the games. And We had a fella join my weekly game, and after he'd been playing with us about 3 months, he said, you know, we've got an opening at our company, and I think you would be great. We want to apply. And I was like, sure. What company is it? He says, well, it's this little company called Origin Systems, and we make computer games. And I was like, well, okay. So he took my resume, a couple of writing samples, some of the homebrew rule sets that we'd been using, some of the homebrew adventures that I'd written, and he took those in, presented them to Warren Spector, who then called me in for an interview. And about 3 weeks later, I started my first job at Origin Systems as a writer. We didn't have designers back then. No one had the title designer. We were a programmer, you were an artist, or you were a writer. Although we did everything a designer would do. We wrote all the conversations, and back then, conversations drove the ultimate games. Everything was setting flags, and it's what moved the game forward. So we basically were the designers on the game, but we were called writers. So yeah, so that's where I'd never really, I mean, other than playing games on the VIC-20, I had not done any programming. I did not even know what a DOS prompt was. So it was really very much being thrown in the deep end, learning as you go. But I did, and I really didn't believe they were going to keep paying me to do that. I couldn't believe they were going to pay me to do what I'd been basically doing for free for all my friends running D&D games. But they did, and then I couldn't believe that it was even anything you could make a career out of, and yet here I am 30-some years later. So, yeah, that's how I got started.
It's amazing how, you know, the fantasy genre of video games have been affected by Dungeons & Dragons. We've had so many guests come on and say, you know, that was their start, and the kind of rules then got transferred into games, and also text adventures and crossing those kind of together.
It is. It's definitely where it started. When I'm talking to young designers or people who think they want to move into design in the game industry, I would tell them, you play Dungeons & Dragons, run Dungeons & Dragons. It's a masterclass in understanding pacing and player input and how to keep your players entertained and keep them moving forward on the storyline and what you do when they go off script. It's very useful skills to learn when you move into design.
It's so amazing how popular it still is. Actually, I went into a record store the other day, and you know, there were vinyls everywhere, and they had a Dungeons and Dragons at the kind of counter, you know, as one of the main items at the moment.
Oh, I can't believe that. I mean, if you'd have gone back and told me, you know, 30 some years ago and said, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is going to be popular, I would never have believed it. I mean, back then we didn't even tell people we played, because, you know, that was still back during all the satanic panic and, you know, oh, it was terrible, Dungeons and Dragons was evil, and, you know, you didn't tell people you played. And if somebody had told me back then that there were going to be people going on late night television, you know, talking about their D&D characters and their adventures, I would never have believed it. So it's kind of fun. I'm really glad to see it come mainstream.
I think Stranger Things helped a lot as well with making it cool for kids these days as well. So, yeah, very, very cool.
Absolutely.
So, you know, when you started at Origin Systems then, I mean, were you, like, familiar with them before? Like, had you played in any of the Ultima games? And kind of describe what you were initially doing at Origin then. What was kind of a typical day for you when you first started?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it. I had never seen an Ultima, but all I had was a VIC-20. Even then, what I had was, you know, pretty much the VIC-20. I think I may have had my Commodore 64 by then. But so I didn't have a game machine. I didn't have any machine that would have run an Ultima, and I didn't know anything about them. So I was really coming into it quite cold. So my very first job was on Ultima 7, and the very first assignment I was given was to research the use of thee and thou and all the grammatical rules around it and make sure that we were using thee and thou correctly in all of our dialogue. So that was my first. That was fun. And I went back in, and I had to go through, they printed all out, and I had to go through page of, you know, hard copy of all of our conversations and do an edit pass to make sure we were using thee and thou correctly.
I was wondering how you learned the Ultima engine then, and did they have, like, in-house training?
No, it was pretty much, here it is, do it. And I had an office mate, and, you know, I would ask him questions, and what we didn't know from them, we would go ask the programmers. But it was really learn by doing. is just total immersion. Here you go. You're going to learn how to do this, which was interesting and hard.
Yeah, it was, so it's like a text parser, but they also had like flags in there. And you know, how did you approach that in a, if you're a writer, you know, it's very different to you know, writing a book or a kind of something that has a start and an end.
It was real interesting to learn to do. I somehow took to it quite naturally. I understood flowcharts, and really flowcharts were our big tool that we used to keep track of what the questions were, what the player was saying, and what those different answers drove and what flags that they set. So we used a lot of flowcharting. And it, once I started doing that, it felt very natural to me to do it. And then it was just a matter of learning the language, which was also interesting because every time we had a new Ultima come out, we had a new engine, usually with a new language. So it wasn't the same. So what you did on Ultima 7 was not what we did on Ultima 7 Part 2 is not what we did on Ultima 8. Different languages, different syntax that you had to learn every time.
And new features like religion and stuff getting added in there.
That was usually started from the beginning. When we would start with an Ultima, Richard would come and say, "This is, here's what the message or the theme of this game is." And so we knew what we were getting into at the very, very beginning. It was interesting, you said the religious thing. The whole religion under Serpent Isle, the whole Chaos Plus Order Equals Balance, that was my work. That was what I focused on. Although I was not on Serpent Isle all the way through, I was taken off to move and moved on to another project. It was an in-house project called Arthurian Legends. But I was there for the beginning of it, and I established that whole religion system. That was my work.
I was wondering as well, did you have any involvement with, I remember Ultima would always have these like extras that would come with it, and you'd have like manuals, and did you have any involvement with those at all?
I did. I was a co-author on the Serpent Isle clue book, Balancing the Scales. So yeah, I did that one.
Well, how much of an influence did the fans have to molding the series?
I would say Richard had more influence than the fans did. He didn't always, I mean, we knew what they liked and we would keep pieces and things that they liked, but they didn't fully guide what we were doing. It was really more Richard's vision. Even when he wasn't directly on the title, like the Serpent Isle title or the Ultima 8 title, it still was his opening statement of this is going to be like this and this is what our theme is. That's what drove us. We had a lot of fun with our fans. They would write us letters. We would get letters, and we would get, you know, they would call our customer service line, and we would hear stories and things like that. I would not say they were terrible. That was not terribly influential on where the game was going. It was really more about bringing Richard's visions to life.
So when did you get into creating a game yourself? I know you created a title that ended up getting cancelled. Or just didn't kind of
Arthurian Legends
come alive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was not just me. That was another, I had a partner named Brian Martin. That was Brian's and mine. It was predominantly Brian's initial vision for it. And he and I then worked together to bring it into a full plan. That was Arthurian Legends. That was a really interesting title because I think it was one of the last of the grassroots projects that, Origin had that was like really started from the trenches. Those of us that were actually out there, you know, writing the games on a day-to-day basis, and we said, hey, this is something we would like to do. And we knew that they were toying with ways to reuse the engines rather than just tossing them away and building a whole new engine. And the idea at the time was, well, we'll take the, you know, after the Ultima moves off of that engine, then we'll do something with that engine to kind of monetize it and make it worth all the time and money we put into it while the Ultimas go on and break the ground on the newest technology. About that time, we had the EA buyout happen. And so that changed a lot of the direction of Origin. It changed a lot. We had to begin then to fit into the more corporate structure, which we hadn't really dealt with. We were really very freewheeling and yeah, it was kind of the golden age of game development, or I like to think of it as that way, because we weren't tied to any particular license. We weren't tied to any particular marketing department. You know, our big deal was you have to hit Christmas, you know, but that was the biggest push, is you had to hit the Christmas goal. So suddenly being put into this much more corporate kind of environment was a big change. And so that's what happened to a lot of the kind of grassroots basic projects. We all kind of got swept up in that.
Was there more pressure to stick to the same engine and not change that much then?
Right. And to produce more of the great big blockbuster Wing Commander, Ultima, those big titles as compared to trying to do any of the smaller stuff.
Well, how hard was it to get female leads in games back then?
Oh, yeah, there weren't any. I joke that when I would go to GDC, but it was called CGDC back then, if I went into the restroom and there was another woman in there, I would get very excited. I'm like, "Hi, my name is Sherry. Who are you?" And we like introduce ourselves because we just weren't used to seeing other women there. Estimates are less than 3% women in the industry at that particular point in time. I would say it was probably even less than that, which always kind of blew my mind. I never really understood why we didn't see more women, because it seemed like a natural place of storytelling and imagination and let's pretend and that kind of stuff. So I always assumed it. And because I had been a DM for so long, my games were always at least 50% female because I played with my friends. So to hit smack in the face with this, women don't play games, I just didn't understand that at all.
I was wondering, did you ever meet Roberta Williams at all?
I did not. I never met Roberta. I tried to get an interview with her when I wrote my book, the Gender Inclusive Game Design book, and she was not giving interviews at that point in time. So I actually never met her.
And with Ultima as well, it kind of changed later on. I know you left, but did you ever get involved in the Ultima Online series and just even as a player?
No, I did not. I was already off to another. I was already off at Her Interactive at that point in time and doing stuff there. I didn't get involved in the online. I didn't really discover MMOs until I played Asheron's Call. It was my first MMO that I played.
Apparently, Ultima Online was absolutely chaotic.
Yeah,
when it first started out,
And people forget that those games back then, Ultima Online, Asheron's Call, Dark Age of Camelot, those games back then. We didn't know anything. They were the first, right? So rules that today, things that today that we just take for granted. Oh, of course, you'd never do that in an MMO. Well, we didn't know that back then. So we were doing a lot of very different things with our MMOs back then. And it was very exciting time.
Well, obviously, in the years and decades that followed, Ultima has become a cult classic now. I mean, looking back on, obviously, your work on the series is renowned. I mean, what are some of your fondest memories? Anything that really stands out from your time working on the series that you're most proud of?
I've got a lot of fun memories of working back then. We worked hard, the work hard, play hard. We really did. We had one Christmas, we decided we were going to have a door decorating contest for the holidays that you could decorate your office door. And my manager was a fella named Mike Sims, and he had a nice thick white beard. Looked like Santa. And so for the whole week before the contest, when people were decorating the doors, we just got a Santa suit and we taped a Santa suit on our door with like ho, 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 Merry Christmas above it. But on the day of the competition, we put our manager into the Santa suit and then taped him to the door. And that was our door decoration.
How long was he there for?
probably an hour at least. And then he was on the door and he had a bag, a Santa sack with candy. And he was just like, Merry Christmas, throwing candy at people when they came down the hallway. So yeah, and then we ran around, we played laser tag in the hallways. Every other Friday, we had a cookout. Lunch was a cookout provided by Orgy. We had a lot of fun. It was really a good time.
That does sound, 'cause it's interesting to hear about the kind of work-life balance, from particularly those early gaming companies when...
There was no work-life balance. We were at the office all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, we generally hear 99-hour working weeks, but you had to have fun while you were at work, yeah.
Yeah, you lived at work. I mean, my husband and I actually met at Origin, and we tease that the reason we met at Origin is because you had to date somebody at work because there was no way you ever had life outside of work.
Yeah. And obviously, technology was developing at a rapid pace around that time. time. A big game changer was obviously CD-ROM when that technology emerged. I mean, do you remember the first time you saw a CD-ROM? And
It
must have felt kind of limitless, did it? What did you think of it when you first...
It was Richard holding up a CD-ROM and telling us that, because we shipped Ultima 7 Part 2, we didn't ship it on CD-ROM, we shipped it on floppies. And I remember Richard talking about it and saying, well, we'd never have enough stuff to fill up an entire CD-ROM. That goes to show you, huh?
And what was the kind of approach to it? Did you think, oh, we're going to have to, you know, fill this with text or images and stuff? Because I guess back then, you know, stuff like video was a very kind of undeveloped thing on CD-ROM.
Back then, yes. Now, when I got over to Her Interactive, and we did full motion video with our very first title there. And then we had to do it where you had to switch discs because we had too much to go on the discs. So, yeah, it was quite a change.
Well, let's talk about that. You know, American Laser Games were famous for like titles like, I remember, Mad Dog McCree. And
Mad Dog McCree, yeah.
Crime Patrol as well. You used to see those amazing titles. Like, they were groundbreaking back then. How did Her Interactive come about and how did you get involved and end up getting a job there?
I was at Game Developers Conference. I was no longer at Origin. I had been laid off and I was looking for work. And I had, it was a very interesting time because I had two interviews. I had an interview with Her Interactive, American Laser Games / Her Interactive, and an interview with Squaresoft. And they both made me offers. And I took the job with Her Interactive. And I often wonder, that was a real divergent point in my career. I often wonder what would have happened if I'd taken the Squaresoft job instead. That would have been a very different path than what I took.
Yeah.
But I was very interested in the female audience and the female players because back then we were battling the knowledge or the wisdom of the industry at the time was girls don't play video games. Girls won't play video games. Mm. And I thought that was ridiculous. Why? Where would you ever think that a girl would not play? Oh, no, girls will not play. So if you talked about making games for the female audience, you might as well have been talking about making games for your office chair. I mean, that was really the reaction you got was, what? They won't play a game. Are you kidding? So when I spoke with the American Laser Games people, they had their vice president of marketing had a fairly large family, and I think she had four daughters, and she had realized that her daughters were not playing the games her sons were, which was what American Laser Games was producing, and that her daughters were interested in it, and she saw it as an opportunity. And she said, there's a whole market out there that we could tap if we did games focused on the female audience. And I took that to heart. I said, yes, I believe that is correct. I believe that's a whole market out there that we are not targeting or that we actually, as an industry, are actively shutting the door on. Yes. I mean, when you put the chainmail bikini babe on the cover of your box and then come asking me, why aren't girls playing my game? It's like, well, they're not even picking it up. You know, how are they going to play it if they won't even pick it up? Because you immediately, from the very beginning, have told them this game is not for you. So anyway, I took the job with them, and it was real interesting because it was a stand-up arcade company. We actually had a full shop with people making and building the cabinets and then shipping them out with the Mad Dog McCree. It was called American Laser Games because the games were all played on laser discs, and we shipped out the laser discs to the different people that had the cabinets. So on one hand, we had that going on, and then we were breaking ground with this new market and this new audience and doing stuff that up to that point in time really had not been done before. We were very lucky in that we had the backing of the Albuquerque Independent School District, and they would let us go in anytime we wanted and talk to the girls, talk to the students. We actually had an advisory committee set up of girls. From the junior high school, said we would bring them in and we'd ask them questions and we would, you know, figure out what it was that they wanted to play. And the result of that was our first title, which was McKinsey and Company.
Yeah, because they had the arcade division before as well, didn't they? And then they must have had a home division because I remember Mad Dog McCree and stuff were ported to everything. So when Her Interactive came around, I guess the whole focus was on home releases as well.
Yes, Yes. And now we still had the arcade group still there because eventually I ended up head of product development there and I had the arcade group under me as well. But yeah, so they were still there. But Patty, the VP of marketing, really wanted to pursue this new market and see if there wasn't something we could do there. Because at that point in time, American Laser Games was being squeezed. In fact, by the time I was there, they were the last U.S.-based arcade company. Everything else was coming from Japan.
And you had people like Sierra doing FMV games as well, right, and expanding into that area.
Yep, exactly.
You mentioned McKenzie & Co., and that was one of the earliest interactive CD-ROM games targeted at young women.
It was.
And, you know, you mentioned before there was that kind of, I guess it would be almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, that image was out there that girls don't play video games. And if they were hearing that, that would put them off playing it. And then when titles like this came along that was specifically targeted at them, I mean, what impact do you think that had on the audience at the time, this title coming along aimed at them?
Oh my gosh, it was so hard. First off, we could not get it on the shelf anywhere. Nobody would let us put the title on the shelf. We could not get into Electronic Boutique. We could not get into Walmart. None of the companies would put us on the shelf because we weren't very big. So we ended up having to market it and sell it ourselves out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, little bitty company, you know, in New Mexico. And it was really hard. So we ended up, man, we tried so many things with marketing that game. We finally found out that we could get it onto the point of purchase at the makeup counters in like Walmarts and the big stores. We could sell it there. They'd let us put it there. We also, we made a lot of arrangements because our game featured clothes from a lot of these different manufacturers. So Sam and Libby Shoes was another one. So we could put it, Sam and Libby Shoes would let us sell the game in their store. Because nobody would put us on the shelf anyplace else because they didn't believe that girls were going to buy games. But I tell you, we, a little bitty company doing it on our own hook, we sold 80,000 copies of that title. And that doesn't sound like much today, but back then, 100,000 units was considered a blockbuster. And we
especially
sold
for a new market as well. It's good going.
And then a year later, Barbie Fashion Designer came out and that blew the doors open for all of us. So because Barbie sold 600,000 units the first year, which, again, nobody had heard of this. And so we quickly blew the lid off that. And, you know, all of a sudden it wasn't girls don't play games. So all of a sudden all the big manufacturers were going, get me some of that. You know, we want that.
Well, I love the idea that it was, you know, created by girls as well. And I was wondering how much input, you know, the producers had about the filming of FMV games, and did they kind of just receive the footage, or was there like a whole storyboarding process and a real kind of detail with it?
There was a lot of detail, and we did it all in Albuquerque. We didn't have a studio in house, but we went ahead and they did have a studio there in Albuquerque. We could rent soundstage time, and we did it with on a green screen with the actors we brought in from Hollywood. We did it all ourselves there. I was creative director on the shoots for those things. So yeah, we did it all there. My favorite story about that is I actually did not do that on McKinsey & Company. McKinsey & Company already had the footage shot when they brought me in, but I did it on our next title, which was the Vampire Diaries title. And we had a scene where at one point in the branching conversations, if you answered the question or talked to right and said the right things at the right time, the vampire would kiss you. And we were filming that segment, and the actor, a very handsome young man, and he's responding to these cues that we'd given him about what the player had said. And at one point, we said the thing that would cause him to kiss the character. And he dropped his head, and he leans into the camera. And I was watching, because again, I was creative director, and all the women behind me went, oh. And it was wonderful. I said, I've done it. This is exactly what I wanted. I wanted to get these kinds of reactions from women when we did this. So yeah, it was really fun.
Oh, that sounds awesome. And yeah, vampires, it's still a theme that's massive today. Yep. And another game as well was Nancy Drew. And what was it like when her interactive got involved with that whole series?
That was really interesting. I was really glad when we were able to do the Nancy Drew. This kind of goes back to what I was talking about, the whole when the industry said, get me some of that, it was all excited about girls' games. Well, they were, but they weren't. When they said, we want games for girls, what they really were saying is, we want a Barbie knockoff. We want fashion, shopping, and makeup for girls ages 6 to 10. And if you brought them anything else, like Vampire Diaries or Nancy Drew, once again, we had trouble getting on the shelves because it wasn't a Barbie clone. They really wanted Barbie clones, which is why at that point in time, we started seeing this market flooded with all these fashion, shopping, and makeup for young girls. And they all tried to look like Barbie. And of course, they didn't do well because only Barbie can be Barbie, right? And so those games didn't do well. So they started cutting their budgets back, less production quality with teams that really didn't even really want to do these things. So the quality dropped, and so the audience was fed not very good stuff, and the game started not making money, and then the industry turned on its heel and said, see, we told you girls don't play games, and turned their back on the girls' market. We actually still see repercussions of that today. Even today, you can't go out and say, I'm going to make games for girls, because the industry still believes they won't do it. Now, you can tell them you're making social games or puzzle games, and we all know that the major market for that is females, women, but they won't call them that. So we still feel the repercussions of what happened back then.
Well, as technology moved on as well, games kind of changed, and MMOs became an absolutely massive area. How did you change your approach to games design when MMOs came around?
I fell back onto my Dungeons & Dragons. That's probably where it really paid off, that I had played so much and designed so much and run so much Dungeons & Dragons, because that's my first MMO, like I said, was Asheron's Call. So what happened was I had somebody reach out to me and say, we want to make an MMO for girls. Can you help us? And I was, absolutely. Sure, I can help that. And then I hung up the phone and thought, well, I guess I better go play one of these if I'm going to help them develop one. And I went out and I went to the local shop, Best Buy here, and I walked to the rack and I looked, and here's Asheron's Call, and it's on sale for $9.99 with a $10 rebate. And I'm like, hey, that sounds good to me. Basically get the game for free. So I brought it home and I booted it up, and I walked my character through this tutorial and walked out into this big open world, and I went, oh, this is it. This is what I want to design for, because this is basically designing Dungeons & Dragons and running a Dungeons & Dragons game for, 100,000 people at a time. How great is that? So I fell back on that. The interesting thing, though, is it really is, when you're designing games, it's about remembering to leave the doors open for everybody and not shutting the doors on your markets. Mm. And so that was always a key feature when I was working either on my own or working with other designers. It's like, make sure that you're not putting any more roadblocks than we need to have. So when you're developing characters, from the very minute you walk into the game and you're doing your character creation, make sure everybody can see themselves reflected in that so that they feel welcome, feel like they want to play this game. Don't shut the door on them. When you're designing your tutorial, look at your different learning styles. Make sure that you're making this available to everybody who wants to learn to play, because you want them to play your game. You want them to give you the money so we can all keep working on our jobs in this, really fun industry. So you want to make sure it's open. So when it came to the MMOs, it really was about making sure those doors were open and making sure that we had something for everybody as wide as we could.
I think that's a great approach as well, because, it can seem to someone who maybe wants to just kind of dip their toe into the world of MMOs, sometimes it can feel a little bit overwhelming, like you don't really know where to start, because it's that much of a big world, isn't it? So I think welcoming new players as best as possible, it's a good approach to it.
Yeah, and tutorials and the first time user experience is just so important, because that's where you catch them. And if they don't feel welcome, if they don't feel comfortable, then they're not going to stay. And now that we've moved into this world of the free-to-play, where we need the people to continually be engaged in our titles, it's not just I go buy it off the shelf and that's the only time I see them. I want them to stay involved because I want them to start, keep sending me money and microtransactions or whatever the free-to-play DLCs. To do that, I have to keep them involved. So I have to make them feel welcome and make them feel like they're you know, making progress and what they're doing is worthwhile. And it can't just be for one particular type of market. We've got to make sure the doors are open as wide as they can be.
You also worked on the probably the biggest franchise in the world with the Star Wars Galaxies and the various expansions as well. I'm interested to hear about, you know, working on a huge franchise like Star Wars, who've got, you know, some really hardcore fans, kind of how you balance the expectations of Star Wars fans to have games and characters a certain way with the creative freedom that obviously you need to develop new content in, you know, such a rich universe. How did that balance kind of work?
So I was not on the launch team for Star Wars Galaxies. I came on post-launch. A lot of the team had already moved on to doing the first DLC, which is the Jump to Lightspeed. So the core team had moved on from there, and I came in post-launch. So I was head of content. So I was a content director. So that was a really important question for me. Although I will say a lot of that was overseen by Lucas. Lucas was not part of Disney at this point in time. So we were still working with Lucas directly. And they had a lot of say into what we did and did not do and could and could not do. Everything we did ran through them. From the minute we had the concept, here's the ideas of what we're going to be doing, to here's the dialogue the characters are going to be saying, to, you know, here's the first beta test of it. They were there and they gave permissions and gave yes and gave us feedback on it. So we had a lot of support in that area from Lucas that helped us kind of make sure we stayed on the track. You know, we did have a little bit of a problem in that the timeline point that they had given us, and that was, I mean, when you go to make a game with them at the time, they would say, okay, here's the point in the timeline where we feel like this game will fit. Mm. And the point in the timeline where they had given us did not have a lot of Jedi, if any at all. And so that, of course, was the big problem with Star Wars Galaxies, is we could not, because of what Lucas said, we could not put Jedi in, because at that point in the timeline, there weren't really any Jedi active in the storylines. So,
yeah, I guess you've got to stick accurately to the lore if you're doing a game like that.
Oh, boy. Yes. Canon is king, for sure. You had to stay with canon. And again, we had LucasArts every step of the way.
I was wondering what the kind of effect of World of Warcraft was when that dropped on the MMO world.
Oh, that was tough. When World of Warcraft came out, we were already out when World of Warcraft was launched and came out. Of course, immediately we were told, go play it. Go play it immediately. And it became the hallmark everybody else was held to.
Yeah.
You had to, you know, everything you did, well, Warcraft is doing this much better. How come you're not? And so that was, it became kind of the stick that we were all beat with. And not just where I was, everybody in the industry was being held up to World of Warcraft. And why aren't you doing as good as World of Warcraft? And you were expected to at least do it as well as they were doing, if not better. And everything was supposed to be, we need to make a World of Warcraft killer. That's everything was pitched that way. And it made it very difficult because what they found is, what we found was we were pressured to adapt many of the World of Warcraft mechanics and put them into our game. And that made it very difficult because if you remember, Star Wars Galaxies was a sandbox. Mm. World of Warcraft is not a sandbox. And so they really wanted us to make it that way.
That must have felt a bit like trying to force a square peg into a round hole, as they say.
Absolutely. Absolutely it did. It was hard, too, because it's like you sell your players. Like if I sell you a magazine and I'm selling you, Time Magazine, and I'm selling you Time Magazine, and every week Time Magazine shows up, and then one week Tennis World shows up instead. It's like, wait, this is not what I'm paying for. I didn't pay for Tennis World. I want Times Magazine.
Yeah.
So we had that going on because we did have a very solid player base, but they liked that particular type of game. And so when we were being pressured to change it into the more of a World of Warcraft style game, it was difficult. It was hard, particularly for the team, because we all loved that day. We loved our game. Anything you have put that kind of hours and that percentage of your life into, you become very attached to it. So it was very hard for us to have to change it.
Well, also you worked on Fusion Fall, which was a like Cartoon Network Universe MMO, but that was also browser-based. What was the difference of, you know, working with a browser compared to a client?
It was difficult back then because it was one of the early, it was the early side of the browser. But truthfully, the bigger problem with FusionFall, and again, I was, when I worked with FusionFall, I was on the initial creative concept side of it. Once it rolled into production, I was not as active with it. I was in creative end of it. Really, the hard part with that was trying to figure out how to merge all those different art styles into one game.
Yeah.
Because
when every Cartoon Network.
We did. We had every Cartoon Network. Yeah. And so you've got to put, you know, Phineas and Ferb in the same world with, you know, Dexter's Lab and Powerpuff Girls, and they all look very different. So that was, that took a lot of wrangling. And because also each one of those cartoons has their own people, we had to, we were negotiating with lots of different people trying to get their approval. So that was really difficult. I actually think, I think we did a really great job. It just, it, it didn't hit them. We were still having, the industry itself was worrying about working with the children's market and what we could do. And that became a difficulty.
Well, obviously one thing about MMOs is they are, you know, totally reliant on servers, which have to be paid for by companies. And, you know, many of the early MMOs now we've seen servers have been turned off over the last decade or so. I mean, how do you feel about that? Because, I mean, you know, we always talk about game preservation is very important to fans of retro gaming, for example. You know, that's always a big topic in our world. How do you kind of feel about, you know, those, the servers being turned off and these worlds kind of been lost forever? And do you think there's anything that, that could be done to preserve them more?
Oh my gosh, it makes me so sad. It makes me so sad because we do lose our history. I mean, we talk about the film industry losing their history because the older prints are disintegrating and falling apart before they can be digitized. But in our case, they literally just vanish. They shut the servers down and, you know, erase them and throw them in the trash heap. And our worlds and all our work is gone. And we don't have the opportunity to teach from them. I mean, we have people coming into the games industry today that never had the opportunity to play Dark Age of Camelot. And that's an important one to go look at. I mean, we, there are lessons to be learned from all of them. I do my archives and my work has been promised to the Strawn Museum play here in the U.S. And I really wish, and I've talked to them about it, I've talked to other people, I really wish we could figure out some way that we could preserve those games almost time capsule like, to where if you really wanted to go see Dark Age of Camelot or something like that, you could go there to the museum and they would have dedicated servers where you could see them preserved the way they were when they were released. Mm. Because there's just so much there that could be learned. There's so many lessons, you know. Some of them have emulators. Of course, you can go see Ultima Online and they have emulators. There's Star Wars Galaxies. There's emulators out there that it's still running and you can still go play it. But even then, it's changed because the teams that keep them running add to them and change them. And they are like they were when they were released. So I really wish there was a way that we could preserve them just so people can learn from them.
Yeah, having a living, breathing world, I guess, is a hard thing to capture and replicate, isn't it, after it's diminished. Yep. But obviously, I mean, we've talked about how, you know, you've always been a pioneer of addressing inclusivity in gaming. And you wrote a book as well, Gender Inclusive Game Design, Expanding the Market. So what prompted you to write that book and how do you feel the conversations evolved since the book was released?
So when I wrote that book, I was approached to write it. The publisher came to me and they'd heard a couple of my talks and they said, would you consider writing a book? And my first answer was, why? Isn't this just common sense? Shouldn't people just know this? This is, just seems like common sense to me and good game design. And apparently not. And they asked me to write it. And so I did. And I thought, okay, this will be the first and there'll be more books. They'll come along and more people explore this. And it didn't. So I'm still kind of surprised that more hasn't been done. But it was kind of one of those things that, you know, somebody had to say it, right? Somebody had to talk about this, opening up the doors and letting more people into our games so that we can grow our industry and grow our markets and keep people playing and keep ourselves employed, bluntly, so we can keep making these fun things. Because if we don't grow our markets and don't keep bringing in the players, we'll be out of work. And that would be very sad. I mean, I like what I do, and I'd like to keep working. So I always thought it was, you know, more would be done and more would be written, and it hasn't. But on the other hand, we are seeing increases in interest in diversity and inclusivity and accessibility. And that makes me happy. I'm glad to see that the interest is still there. People are still talking about it, and there are efforts being made to keep the doors open for everybody. And so I'm glad to see that. The numbers are increasing. Like I said, when I was first starting, it was probably less than 3% women in development. And now we're somewhere around 22 to 25% women, which is amazing. I'm so glad to see that. It's not where I'd like it to be, but it's certainly better. We're seeing our diversity in representation. We're seeing more Hispanics and more people of color coming in, and that's good, because the more voices at the table we have, the better our products are.
Do you think the indie game scene has also helped, you know, give people a kind of leg up or entry into the video game world that usually wouldn't?
It does. Absolutely, it does. It also helps us the way the indie film movement helps the film industry. It allows us to experiment with new styles and new gameplay ideas and things like that. I believe that we still need to continue working on our diversity in our educational programs, so that the people who are coming out with the skill sets to do the indie games are diverse. That's not yet where it should be, but it is still improving. We're getting better.
Well, Sherry, it's been incredible to hear some of your history in the industry. What are you working on these days, Anna? Anything we should be looking out for from you?
I'm currently doing quite a bit of contract and consulting work. I actually tried to retire. That didn't work, because people apparently still want to talk about diversity and inclusivity. So primarily what I'm doing is a lot of consulting and contract work, particularly around the diversity, inclusivity, and accessibility areas, which is exciting to me. It's exciting to me that people want that they want that kind of input into their games, and they understand that, you know, keeping our markets expanding is good for everybody.
Yeah, 100%. Breaking down barriers, and gaming should be accessible to everyone. You know, the more the merrier. It's
right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sherry, it's been amazing to hear some of your memories, and you know, you've had an incredible career, and hopefully you do get some time to relax at some point. But thank you so much for coming on and being our guest this week and chatting with us. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.